everyone, and welcome to episode 147 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Sobalski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. Well, this week it is just me on the podcast, and it is once again time for medieval story time. Every once in a while, I like to bring you some primary sources from the Middle Ages to get us as close as possible to the actual words of the people who were living back then. So the sources we're using today are going to be in translation because many of the sources that were written back in the day were written either in Latin or older versions of the languages we use today, which means that they're pretty inaccessible to our ears. But still, this is as close as we can get to the people's voices from the Middle Ages, and I still think that is a great thing. So medieval story time today is going to be all about animals, and we'll be getting to story time right after this.
At Cal Tire, we like free as much as you do. So for the Bring On Spring Savings event, we're offering a free brake inspection, free alignment check, and a free installation on a set of 4 Nokian or Nordman tires. After the harsh driving conditions of winter, now is the perfect time to have your vehicle inspected or buy a new set of tires. Get quality service from the tire experts that you can trust. Visit caltire.com/marchsavings to view details. Hurry, offer ends March 31st.
Tired of building someone else's dream? Nova Scotia is hiring skilled trades workers to come work where the people are warm, the city's vibrant, and an incredible coastal lifestyle lets you play as hard as you work. To learn more, visit liveinnovascotia.com.
Power your home with Rogers Ignite and get the ultimate internet experience with our most reliable and fastest fiber-powered internet. Game, stream, and binge all you want, and do it all on multiple devices throughout your home with our reliable Wi-Fi technology. For a limited time, get Ignite Internet starting at $59.99 after a credit of $30 per month for a year, subject to change. Only with Rogers. Visit Rogers.com or your local Rogers store for details.
So in the Middle Ages, animals had a huge impact on the lives of just about everybody, rich and poor, urban and rural. Everybody had access to animals. Everybody saw animals. This is farm animals. This is animals that you use to ride to get around to places. This is pets. This is all sorts of animals that are just part of everyday life, the fabric of medieval life. So of course, they are a perfect opportunity for people to look at them, come up with stories about them, or use them as examples when they're trying to teach people lessons. So if you listen to the podcast from last year on pigs with Jamie Kreiner, or the one this year on the medieval ass with Catherine Smithies, then you've already heard a little bit about the way that animals were perceived of in the Middle Ages. But today I thought I would bring you some actual primary sources from the Middle Ages to get at what people thought about these animals in their own words, or as close as we can get to them. A couple of these are going to be recent translations, and a couple of these are not going to be recent translations. And that is because, as a medievalist on a budget, I get a lot of my translations from used bookstores, and that's still a good place to get them. I would say if you find a translation of a primary source in a used bookstore, they can often be quite good. You can try and compare them to ones that are more recent, if possible, but you might want to be a little bit suspicious of the scholarship that is usually in the introductions to these translations, because some of that stuff can be outdated. But the actual translations themselves can be quite good, and part of that is because people were much more familiar with Latin back in the day. And back in the day, I mean in the 20th century. So you can still find some good translations in a used bookstore like I have, but just pay attention to the introduction and maybe do your own investigation when you're trying to find out the information that is contained within the introduction about what we know about those particular texts. So I thought I would start today off with probably the weirdest story that I'm going to be telling you today. It's from the Gesta Romanorum, which is the Deeds of the Romans. And this, like pretty much everything I'm going to be talking about today, was written anonymously, which is really common in the Middle Ages. And these were stories that were supposed to be tales of the Romans. And you'll see from this story, and if you ever read the actual rest of the Gesta Romanorum, that it's really kind of medieval stories painted with a Romanized brush. So these are not stories that are told by Roman scholars by any means. Often they're just kind of fables that have the word Caesar thrown in every once in a while. So you'll see that there's the word emperor. You'll see in this story there's a knight. And of course, knights were not around in the Roman Empire. But you still get the gist of it. They still are getting a point across by each of these stories. And I mentioned this because actually it's explicitly at the end of each of the stories is an application or a moral of the story. So pretty much every story that anyone tells in the Middle Ages, it has a moral application. Some of these are funny. Most of them are supposed to be instructive, and they often have a Christian bent to them. They're allegorical. They're comparing what you've just heard in the story to Jesus's life often, and that's something that you're going to see in this story. So this is a story about a knight, a toad, and a snake. And in the Middle Ages, of course, snakes are usually pretty bad because they are related to Satan in the Bible, although that's not the case in this particular story, as you'll hear. Toads are almost equivalent in a lot of cases. When you see a toad in medieval art, it's almost always a baddie. They were thought to be venomous. They were thought to be a shape that demons would take. If you listen to the podcast on Hermine de Rheims not too long ago with Renate Blumenfeld-Kaczynski, that story also has a lot of toads in it. And you see them in Memento Mori. There are toads that are devouring people. So toads are bad, as you will see here. But strangely, the snake is not the bad guy in this. So I hope that you'll enjoy this story. It is a fun one because it's just so medievally weird. So this is labeled Tale 99, which is subtitled Of Christ's Manly Contest and Victory. And it comes from a translation of the Gesta Romanorum by Charles Swan and Winard Hooper. In the reign of Caesar, there lived a noble and valiant knight who once rode by a certain forest and beheld a serpent engaging with a toad. The latter obtained the mastery, which when the knight saw, he assisted the serpent, and grievously wounding the toad, reduced it to seek safety in flight. But the conqueror was also affected by the toad's venom. The knight turned homeward, and for a long time lay sick of his wound. At last he made his will and prepared himself for death. Now as he reclined near the fire, utterly hopeless of life, the serpent which he had preserved entered the apartment. When the attendants beheld it, they said, my lord, a serpent has entered the room. When the knight saw it, he recollected that it was the same he had aided in its contest with the toad, and through which he was laid upon his bed incurable. Do not molest it, said the knight. I do not believe that it will harm me. The serpent glided towards him, and applying its tongue to the wound, sucked up the poison till its mouth was quite full, and then, hastening to the door, cast it out. It returned twice to the wound, and did as before, until the venom was exhausted. The knight commanded milk to be given to the serpent, which it instantly drank, and no sooner had it done so than the toad from which the wound had been received entered, and again attacked the serpent in revenge for it having healed the knight. The latter, seeing this, said to his servants, without doubt, my friends, this is the toad which I wounded in defense of that serpent, and from which I derive all my infirmity. If it conquer, it will attack me. Therefore, as you love your master, kill it incontinently. The servants, obedient to the knight's command, slew it with swords and clubs, while the serpent, as if to praise and thank its defender, twined around his feet and then departed. The knight completely recovered his health. Application. My beloved, the emperor is God, the knight, Christ, the toad is the devil, and the serpent, man. So this is a really entertaining story where you have a toad poisoning a knight and then a serpent coming in and actually sucking the poison out of the wound and spitting out three times. And then you have the serpent being brought to the knight with milk, which is something that is a pretty ancient trope as well. This one is a bit of a stretch in saying that the serpent is man. It's weird to think that man is getting the poison out of Jesus, but they have to have some sort of a moral to the story. So that's what it is. So that is a fun story from the Gesta Romanorum about toads and serpents. And it's an interesting one because the serpent is not actually the bad guy in it. So speaking of fables and morals, I think none of us can think about fables or morals without thinking about Aesop. And that is something that is really common to the Middle Ages as well. They were aware of Aesop's fables and they told them and retold them to each other. And one of the books that I was happy to come across lately is a book of fables that was written down by Marie de France. So Marie de France is somebody that I have talked about before on this, and I've read her lay in a couple of medieval story times in the past, so I'm obviously a big fan. Marie de France is writing in the 12th century, and she's funny because she always makes sure that you know it's her. She says that it's folly to be forgotten. So she says, this is me, my name is Marie, I'm from France, and I'm writing down these fables that came to us from Aesop. So she's actually giving the kind of history behind the fables as she's writing them down. So I thought I would bring you a fable that is retold by Marie de France with her own spin on what the moral of the story is. Many of Marie's stories, lays, and fables are meant to tell people to stay in their place, to know their place, and to not try and rise above it. So she's not exactly addressing peasants. She's probably addressing her peers, so the nobility. But everybody is being advised to know their place and to be grateful for their place in life. So I thought I would bring you the fable of the peacock from Marie's Fables. And there are a whole bunch of fables. This is just one of many. This is from a translation by Harriet Spiegel. Once there was a peacock who was discontented, angry too, because his voice, he said, was not befitting or appropriate. He told all this to Destiny. That lady asked him then if he weren't with his beauty satisfied. Such fine adornment she'd supplied. His feathers lovelier made she than any birds he'd ever see. The peacock answered that he feared he was of all the vilest bird, for he could not sing prettily. Then she responded, let me be, your beauty should suffice for you. Oh no, he said, I tell you true, because the nightingale petite has finer voice, my shame's complete. This is how many folks behave. The more they have, the more they crave. So this is a pretty obvious moral. Be grateful for what you have. And I don't know if she's particularly addressing ladies here about being happy with your beauty and not worrying about having a voice. Marie is a pretty tricky narrator. She's a pretty tricky writer. So it's very possible that she's speaking to ladies and maybe pointing this a little bit. But this is obviously one that is pretty straightforward in its moral. So having read about the peacock in this fable by Marie de France, I wanted to learn more about peacocks in the Middle Ages. So I know that people ate them. They used to redress them with their feathers before they sent them to the table, which is a really interesting thing. I think something I'd want to see, although maybe not eat. And I knew that people had peacocks as sort of decorative pets that would walk around castle gardens. And most people would probably, if they were in an urban setting, probably have some familiarity with a peacock, only because they are so incredibly loud. If you've ever come across a peacock, you know that they are completely loud. So one of the places I wanted to look at to learn more about peacocks was in the bestiary. So I pronounce this bestiary because that is how I've heard people pronounce it, but it's one of these words I'm never quite sure about. So bear with me. So a bestiary is a collection of information about animals that, again, usually had a moral implication about the animal in particular. So there's always something to do with Jesus when it comes to pretty much every animal in the bestiary. So the copy that I have is an old translation by T.H. White, so the guy who wrote The Once and Future King. And I looked up the peacock in this particular 12th century bestiary, and it's not particularly interesting, but there is a note from T.H. White at the bottom of it that says that the person who compiled this particular bestiary missed an opportunity, because there is an ancient Greek quote about peacocks that says, when he sees his feet, he screams wildly, thinking they are not in keeping with the rest of his body. So that is a quote from Epiphanius, which is not actually part of the bestiary, but a note that's written in there by T.H. White, which I think is really funny, because when I think about peacocks, all I can think about is the way they scream. Although I'll be thinking about Marie de France as well after this. So looking in the bestiary, again, this is a compilation of information about animals. And if you've read my work before, you're probably familiar with the fact that my favorite entry is about beavers. And one of the things that happens in bestiaries is they try to make a connection between the name of the animal, the Latin name of the animal, and why it has that name. So where did it come from? And so my funniest one, the one I like best, is about beavers, because it talks about how people get oil from the beaver, castor oil. And the connection is made between beavers being named castor and castration. So the beaver one is where if there is a hunter that is chasing the beaver for its oil, the beaver will cut off its own testicles, it'll bite them off, and it'll throw them at the hunter so that the hunter is not going to chase them anymore. And that is just such a hilarious image that it's my favorite one. But of course, there are a million other ones that are in the bestiary, not quite a million, but a lot of different animals. Some of them are mystical, some of them are regular farm animals, and some are from far away. One that I wanted to bring to you is an animal that might be far away or mystical, maybe not if you're Scottish because it is the official animal of Scotland, but it is the unicorn. And I thought I would bring this to you as an example because, well, I have a connection to make with it later. So here from T.H. White's translation of the bestiary is unicorn. Unicornus, the unicorn, which is also called rhinoceros by the Greeks, is of the following nature. He is a very small animal like a kid, excessively swift, with one horn in the middle of his forehead, and no hunter can catch him. But he can be trapped by the following stratagem. A virgin girl is led to where he lurks, and there she is sent off by herself into the wood. He soon leaps into her lap when he sees her, and embraces her, and hence he gets caught. Our Lord Jesus Christ is also a unicorn spiritually, about whom it is said, "And he was beloved like the son of the unicorns." And in another psalm, "He hath raised up a horn of salvation for us in the house of his son David." The fact that it has just one horn on its head means what he himself said, "I and the Father are one." Also, according to the apostle, the head of Christ is the Lord. It says that he is very swift because neither principalities, nor powers, nor thrones, nor dominations could keep up with him, nor could hell contain him, nor could the most subtle devil prevail to catch or comprehend him, but by the sole will of the Father he came down into the virgin womb for our salvation. It is described as a tiny animal on account of the lowliness of his incarnation. As he said himself, "Learn from me because I am mild and lowly of heart." It is like a kid or scapegoat because the Savior himself was made in the likeness of sinful flesh, and from sin he condemned sin. The unicorn often fights with elephants and conquers them by wounding them in the belly. So obviously you can see there is a direct parallel made at length between the unicorn and Jesus, and that is something that happens for pretty much every animal within the bestiary. It's either connected with God or with Jesus or with another figure from the Bible, from biblical stories. That one makes me laugh because after this long allegorical explanation with how this unicorn is like Christ, there is that extra little tidbit that you get at the end. Oh, well, by the way, don't forget the fact that unicorns fight elephants and they stab them in the belly. Now, I think that if you've come across medieval stuff before, the information about the unicorn is not too surprising to you. It's kind of horse-like, it's pretty small, and you need to have a virgin in the forest to catch it. It's mystical. It's called a rhinoceros, but it's not very much like a rhinoceros. And so the next primary source I want to bring to you deals with a unicorn from somebody who actually saw it or talked to people who actually saw it. So one of the texts that tells us a lot about the medieval world and how people saw it and perhaps experienced it is the Travels of Marco Polo. And this is a really interesting text because it was contentious back in the day. It's contentious now. People are not sure whether Marco Polo himself went and traveled, whether he talked to people and he compiled their stories into one story, or maybe this is a whole bunch of people's information. So it's a contentious text and there's lots of debate about Marco Polo. Needless to say, the actual text itself has really cool information in it that doesn't come from nowhere. It comes from people's experiences and what they've told to each other. Sometimes it's kind of like a game of telephone, I think, the way the information gets back to this actual story. But he does talk about unicorns in it, and I think this is fascinating and a good contrast to what's found in the bestiary. So this is from the Penguin version of Marco Polo's travels, and it was translated by Nigel Cliff. So in this part of the text, Marco Polo is talking about a kingdom called Basmen, which the editor has sort of identified as possibly being Sumatra. "They have wild elephants and plenty of unicorns, which are scarcely smaller than an elephant. The unicorn has the hair of a buffalo and feet like an elephant's. In the middle of its forehead is a single horn, very thick and black. I assure you it does no harm with its horn, but only with its tongue and knees, for it has long sharp spines on its tongue, and whenever it wishes to hurt anyone, it tramples him and holds him down with its knees, then slashes him with its tongue. It has a head like a wild boar's, and it always holds it bowed towards the ground. It is perfectly content to wallow in mud and mire. It is a very ugly beast to look at. It is nothing like the animal we talk of and describe in our parts, where we say that it lets itself be caught by a virgin. In fact, I can tell you it is the exact opposite of what we believe it to be. So we've seen that the bestiary gives lip service to the fact that this is a rhinoceros, or the word unicorn is related to rhinoceros. But this description from Marco Polo's travels is by someone who's actually seen a rhinoceros, whether they're describing it to the guy who's writing, whether that's Marco Polo or someone else, or someone who's actually seen it, whether Marco Polo has seen this rhinoceros or not. It's hilarious, I think, because here's somebody who's describing this big animal. It has one horn. It sounds like a unicorn, and yet it does not act like a unicorn. It doesn't look like a unicorn. It's an ugly elephant with buffalo hair. And that just cracks me up, I think, because it's one of these things where you can see people, and this is the 13th century, talking about, well, we've been told this about unicorns, but this is not actually what they're like. So the unicorn thing is actually one that I think is really funny. And one of the other things that we maybe tend to make fun of medieval people for is their drawings, especially their drawings of exotic animals. And I mean, they are funny, but imagine trying to draw an exotic animal just from somebody's description of it. It is a tough thing. So I thought I would bring you another example from Marco Polo's travels of an animal that you would have a hard time drawing if you'd never seen one. So he's talking about Zanzibar here. He says, "There are also many giraffes, which are very beautiful creatures to look at. I will describe their appearance for you. Now, you should know that the giraffe's body is short and its hindquarters rather low, because she has little hind legs. But her forelegs and neck are very long, so that her head is fully 3 paces above the ground. She has a small head and does no harm to anyone. As to color, she is dappled red and white all over, and this is a very beautiful thing to see." Now imagine trying to draw a giraffe based on just that description. I think my giraffe would look really ridiculous and probably not much like a giraffe at all. So I think maybe we should cut these people some slack. If you're a monk that is drawing in a scriptorium, it's fine. Just do your best. So there's one last description that I wanted to bring to you from the travels of Marco Polo, and that is, when we think about the Middle Ages, one of the animals that's ubiquitous, it's ubiquitous then, it is now, is dogs. We see dogs everywhere, and there are dogs all over medieval descriptions and manuscripts. You see them all over the place. Some of the dogs are pets, and they are kept almost like babies, like they are in some places today, but they often have jobs. So these dogs are guard dogs, or they will fetch or retrieve things, they will hunt, they will pull carts. They're sometimes used as guide dogs, which I think is really fascinating. We're not getting into today, but it's a really fascinating thing that happened in the Middle Ages as well, the use of guide dogs to help people see. But one of the things I had never come across before now was a description of sled dogs. And so here's a description from Marco Polo that's talking about the north part of Asia. It's a little bit vague, but this is probably in Russia, talking about sled dogs. So here we go. "You may also take my word for it that there is a stretch of this king's country where no horses can go, because it is a land of many lakes and springs, and so covered with ice and mire and mud that no horse can cross it. This bad tract extends the distance of a 13-day journey. At the end of each day's journey, there is a post house where the messengers who crisscross the country can lodge. At each of these posts, there are at least 40 huge dogs, each barely smaller than an ass. These dogs transport the messengers from one post to the next, that is, for a day's journey, and I will tell you how. Now you should know that because horses cannot be used throughout this journey on account of ice and mud, for those 13 stages run the length of a great valley between two mountains, and so the ice and mud are as bad as I have told you. For this reason, just as I have told you, horses cannot pass. And because a wheeled cart could not pass there either, they have had sledges constructed in such a way that they glide over the ice and mud and mire without sinking into them much at all. Sledges of this sort are common in our parts, for they are the kind that are used to carry hay and straw in winter when it is raining heavily and very muddy underfoot. They spread a bear skin on the sledge, and then one of these messengers jumps up and takes his seat. 6 dogs, the big ones I told you about, pull these sledges. These dogs have no one to guide them but make directly for the next post, capably hauling the sledge across ice and mud alike. And so they go from one post to another. In actual fact, the keeper of the post house also mounts on a sledge, and it is pulled by a team of dogs which he drives by on the best and most direct route. When they arrive at the next post, they find dogs and sledges waiting to take them on their way, while those that have brought them so far turn back. And so they continue for the duration of this journey, pulled all the time by dogs. Now, I suppose that as a historian and as a Canadian, I probably should have guessed that people were using dog sleds back in the day in northern Russia, but it's not something that I ever thought about. So coming across this description of dog sleds in Russia is really cool, I think, and maybe something that you haven't come across before either. So obviously it's something that Marco Polo thought his peers had never come across either, so he wanted to bring that back to them as a little nugget of information, and I think it's still a fascinating nugget of information today. So I talked earlier on about bestiaries and how they're a collection of information about animals. And a lot of them are based on a bunch of different sources, but heavily based on a text called the Physiologus, which is from about the 4th century. And it looks like it may have been from Egypt. And so this is a collection that's kind of like the bestiary in that it has loads and loads of information about animals. And it also connects them back to the life of Jesus in a very similar way to the later bestiaries do. And there is a fairly new translation of the Physiologus by Michael J. Curley. And I wanted to bring you one of the examples from this particular book because there is a retelling of it from early England that I think is really cool. And I want to get to that in a second. So let's read about the whale from the Physiologus, translation by Michael J. Curley. So this section is 31 and it's titled On the Whale, that is the Aspidochelion. Physiologus spoke of a certain whale in the sea called the Aspidochelion that is exceedingly large like an island, heavier than sand, and is a figure of the devil. Ignorant sailors tie their ships to the beast as to an island and plant their anchors and stakes in it. They light their cooking fires on the whale, but when he feels the heat, he urinates and plunges into the depths, sinking all the ships. You also, O man, if you fix and bind yourself to the hope of the devil, he will plunge you along with himself into hellfire. The whale has another nature. When he grows hungry, he opens his mouth very wide, and many a good fragrance comes out of his mouth. Tiny little fish, catching the scent, follow it and gather together in the mouth of that huge whale, who closes his mouth when it is full and swallows all those tiny little fish, by which is meant those small in faith. We do not find the larger and perfect fish approaching the whale, for the perfect ones have achieved the highest degree. Indeed, Paul said, "We are not ignorant of his cunning." Job is a most perfect fish, as are Moses and the other prophets. Joseph fled the huge whale, that is, the wife of the prince of cooks, as it is written in Genesis. Likewise, Thecla fled Thamyrdis, Susanna the two wicked old men of Babylon, Esther and Judith fled Artaxerxes and Holofernes. The three boys fled the king Nebuchadnezzar, the huge whale. And Sarah, the daughter of Regellus, fled Nasmodeus, as in Tobiah. Physiologus, therefore, spoke well of the Aspidochelion, the great whale. So there we have the whale, some of its attributes, and of course the ways that it connects back to the Bible, which is ever important for the people who are writing from the 4th century on until the Middle Ages and beyond it. So Physiologus is obviously a very influential text. It had a huge impact on all sorts of different things, bestiaries being not the least of them. So why did I pick whale out of all of these things that are mentioned in it? Well, it's because I came across a poem that was written in Old English about a whale, and you'll find a lot of the things in it are very familiar. But what's cool about this poem is that it is Old English poetry, and Old English poetry is very cool to listen to, even in translation. So you do have to listen to Old English in translation because for the people who are not familiar with it, it is a completely different language from our language today. So a lot of the rules are different. It sounds very different. If you looked at it, you would not usually be able to read it. It is not Shakespeare's language. It is even older than that. So this is in translation for both of our sakes, yours and mine. A quick word about Old English poetry, just because it's very cool and something I want to mention to you, is that Old English poetry doesn't tend to rhyme like later poetry does. Instead, it is alliterative. So it really focuses on having a similar sound, usually at the beginning of a word, several times throughout the line. And each line is divided into two halves. So there's the first half of the line, then there's a gap called the caesura, and then there's the second half of the line. And so you often have alliteration that's the same in the first half of the line, and then alliteration that's the same in the second half of the line. So this is in translation. A lot of the alliteration you will miss, but you can still catch some of it. So I thought it was worth mentioning to you. This alliteration is really, really cool, which is why you want to have good translations of whatever you come across. This translation is by Charles W. Kennedy, and he doesn't really try all that hard. Well, that's maybe not fair. It doesn't seem like he works diligently to keep the alliteration as diligently as perhaps some other translators do. There's a reason that I always recommend Roy Liuza's translation of Beowulf. That's because he really tries to preserve that alliteration in the translation of Beowulf that he does into modern English. And it's the same with Tolkien and Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. That is in Middle English, but it does have a lot of that same alliteration, which is really, really pretty and something that you don't hear every day. So now that I've said all that about alliteration, there isn't all that much of it in this particular translation, but you might still hear it, and you will definitely hear the influence of Physiologus. Old English poetry is cool because it's very evocative, and I think gets at this reality of living in a place that is surrounded by oceans, and hopefully that comes across in this translation. So this is from a collection called An Anthology of Old English Poetry. Again, it's translated by Charles W. Kennedy, who hopefully I haven't maligned too much. And this poem is just called The Whale. Now I will fashion the tale of a fish with wise wit singing in measured strains, the song of the great whale. Often unwittingly, ocean mariners meet with this monster. Vastidacalan, fierce and menacing, the great sea swimmer of the ocean streams. Like a rough rock is the whale's appearance, or as if they were swaying by the shore of the sea, a great mass of sedge in the midst of the sand dunes. So it seems to sailors. They see an island, and they firmly fasten their high-prowed ships with anchor ropes to the land that is no land, hobble their sea steeds at ocean's end, land bold on the island and leave their barks moored at the water's edge in the waves' embrace. There they encamp, the sea-weary sailors. Fearing no danger, they kindle a fire. High on the island, the hot flames blaze, and joy returns to travel-worn hearts, eager for rest. Then, crafty and evil, when the whale feels the sailors are fully set and firmly lodged, enjoying fair weather, suddenly with his prey, ocean's guest plunges down in the salt wave, seeking the depths, in the hall of death, drowning sailors and ships. Such is the manner of demons, the devil's way, luring from virtue, inciting to lust, by secret power deceiving men's souls, that they may seek help at the hands of their foes, and fixed in sin, find abode with the fiend. Sly and deceitful, when the devil perceives out of hell torment that each of mankind of the race of men is bound with his ring, then with cunning craft the dark destroyer takes proud and humble who here on earth through sin did his will. Seizing them suddenly, shrouded in darkness, estranged from good, he seeks out hell, the bottomless abyss in the misty gloom, even as the great whale who drowns the mariners, sea steeds, and men. A second trait has he, the proud sea thrasher, even more marvelous. When hunger torments and the fierce water monster is fain of food, then the ocean warden opens his mouth, unlocks his wide jaws, and a winsome odor comes from his belly. Other kinds of fish are deceived thereby, all eagerly swimming to where the sweet fragrance comes flowing forth. In unwary schools they enter within till the wide mouth is filled. Then swiftly the whale over his sea prey snaps his grim jaws. So it is with him in this transient time, who takes heed to his life too late and too little, letting vain delights through their luring fragrance ensnare his soul, till he slips away, soiled with sin, from the King of Glory. Before them, the devil, after death's journey, throws open hell for all who in folly fulfilled the lying lusts of the flesh against the law. But when the wily one, expert in evil, has brought into bonds in the burning heat those cleaving to him, laden with sins, who during their life days did his bidding, on them after death, his savage jaws he snaps together the gates of hell. Who gather there know no retreat, no return out thence, any more than the fishes swimming in the sea can escape from the grip of the great whale. Therefore, by every means should every man serve the Lord God and strive against devils by words and works, that we may behold the King of glory. In this transient time let us seek for peace and healing at his hands, that we in grace may dwell with him so dear and have his bliss and blessedness forever. So I think you could still catch some of the rhythm of the Old English poetry with the two heavy stresses at the beginning of the line and the two heavy stresses at the end of the line. And there is some nice alliteration there. I shouldn't have been so mean to Charles. Where you have things like cunning craft, dark destroyer, all sorts of that kind of stuff. A lot of sibilant sounds like the S's, which are kind of hissy. And all of this is the type of thing that I imagine people reciting in front of a fire. Kind of hissy and dark. And what I love about Old English as well is that they have different words that are descriptive words for the same thing. So instead of just saying whale all the time, they say sea thrasher, water monster, ocean warden, ocean guest. And it's just really cool, I think. So I wanted to end there also because it says at the end, in this transient time, let us seek for peace. And of course, that is speaking to me in the present moment. So I hope you've enjoyed this trek through medieval primary sources, talking about animals, these things that were so familiar to medieval people. And I hope that you've maybe learned some things about how they conceived of animals, how they thought about animals in terms of worldview and what this meant to them. And yeah, I hope it was just a fun trip down primary source lane. So thank you for joining me for medieval animal story time. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website, as well as how he had a great experience at Medieval Academy of America, right?
Hey, hey, yes, I did. It's always super fun getting back into conference season and could do it from comfort of our own homes for most of us. It was kind of the split conference. So
yeah, it was a hybrid conference. So some of us were at home and some of us were actually in Virginia. So that's something. It's exciting.
Yeah, it was about 2.5 days of really good, interesting medieval papers. I think it got off to a really good start with Roland Betancourt's plenary address.
Yeah, I loved it. It was so good. It was really a call to everybody who's working out there and how we can reach out to people beyond the borders of the ivory tower. So, of course, that was my jam. What did you like about it?
First of all, it was really timely. I kind of imagined that he was kind of rewriting it in the last couple of days with a lot of reference talking about Ukraine and issues there. But yeah, it was a really good look at medievalism and global history. And that kind of kicked off the whole theme of the conference.
Yeah, I really liked that. There was a lot about interdisciplinarity, which is, again, something I'm really into. And he started that off really well, I thought, by examining ways that we can think about the medieval world in the modern world. And yeah, it was really great. So congrats to Roland, because that was an amazing plenary to start things off. What else did you like about MAU?
Well, you were not just a watcher, but you were a participant. You were in one of the sessions.
Yes, I was in a roundtable for graduate students, trying to pump them up a little bit about what they could do in graduate school to get themselves ready for careers, whether that's within the academy or outside of it. I am not the best person to give advice for within the academy, so we had a bunch of people in that session which were much more helpful for that track. But I was talking more about how to get a career or work your career outside of the academy.
And that was really cool. And I enjoyed all the speakers in that. I also, I think if I had a favorite paper, it would be Eugene Smelyansky. And he talked about forests in late medieval Nuremberg. And the interesting of that is that if you go to Nuremberg today, all the trees around the city are like coniferous, like pines and spruce and stuff like that. But that's not how it was until the late Middle Ages. It was actually mostly deciduous, but this guy in a company he formed in like the 14th century did a tree planting operation. that was their business. And of course, they're selling the wood to the city for charcoal, but instead of planting deciduous, they're all just planting pine and coniferous. And so it goes on for a couple hundred years. And now everyone thinks that Nuremberg is a naturally coniferous town in that part of Germany, but no, that was really kind of a fascinating little bit of environmental history for me.
Yeah, I like environmental history. It always has something new to teach us. And I didn't know there was a tree planting initiative. That's something I had to do in elementary school. It's cool that that's something that was happening back in the day too. And I guess you do want to restore the forest because you do need wood for pretty much everything back in the day. I really liked all the plenaries. I thought they were really good. There was the Cara plenary, which had Sierra Lomuto, Kavita Finn, Matthew Vernon, and David Maldonado Rivera. And that one was a real standout for me, talking about, again, ways in which we can connect things across fields and across time. And I just thought they were all spectacular. And of course, there was one that was celebrating Monica Green, who I think is just the best. She's the bee's knees. And that was a really interesting one too, talking about medicine and her work. Now, for people who weren't there, Monica says, everybody needs to learn how to read a phylogenetic tree. So that we can all learn about the genetics of the Black Death. But she also was coming at that from a medievalist perspective, as somebody who edited texts. So that's Monica Green's advice to everyone. Learn how to read a phylogenetic tree.
Wow. I guess I have to start on that. Again, the Medieval Academy, a lot of senior scholars talk there, a lot of really bright minds. So it's always fun to listen to and hear what people are talking about. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah, it was a good event. And even though there was a week off where I was doing March break type stuff, I'm still thinking about that conference too. So it was great. All right. So what's going on the website this week, Peter?
Well, we've started partnering with some history YouTubers to take the kind of the content that's been created on medievalist.net and make it into really cool videos. You know, I'm a big supporter of reaching out to a larger audience, and YouTube is the place to be. I think if you want to kind of talk about history, there's amazing YouTubers. And so we've partnered with a couple of them. And right now there's this video on History Marché about the walk to Canossa. It did really cool animations with it. I was really happy to see it. So you'll be seeing more of that on the site. And I'm looking forward to doing more. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah, you're a big fan of YouTube. So this is your dream coming true.
I've been wanting to do this for a long time. And it's probably better to work with others that are really, really good at it, as opposed to, you know, my feeble attempts at making animations. So.
Well, you don't need to reinvent the wheel. I think that it's all about partnership and team effort. So that's going to be really exciting. So hopefully we will be able to see that soon.
So you can see that video, and there should be two or three videos coming out every month from these kind of YouTube channels. And we'll let you know more about them as they come through.
Right. So you're going to be letting people know at Medievalist across social media when these videos come out. So people can just keep an eye on social media and they won't miss it.
For sure. And if you're on our Patreon, you can see those videos early.
Ooh, I love that. I love that. Well, thanks, Peter, for stopping by. See you later.
Thanks.
Thank you, as always, to all of Medievalist.net's patrons on Patreon.com for all your support. You'll find amazing stuff for patrons, like subscriptions to Medieval Warfare Magazine and the Medieval Magazine, a book club, and our exclusive maps by Tina Ross. And you also get to feel good about helping Medievalist.net's podcasters keep bringing you fun historical content, including yours truly. So thank you. For all the details, please visit Patreon.com/Medievalists. For everything from animals to Al-Andalus, follow Medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at Medievalists. You can find me, Danielle Cebulski, across social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5-Minute Medievalist. And you can find my books at all your favorite bookstores, where you can get hold of How to Live Like a Monk, Medieval Wisdom for Modern Life, in hardcover, ebook, and audiobook. And until March 25th, you can get a signed copy of How to Live Like a Monk from Abbeville Press directly at abbeville.com. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself an amazing day.
Power your home with Rogers Ignite and get the ultimate internet experience with our most reliable and fastest fiber-powered internet. Game, stream, and binge all you want, and do it all on multiple devices throughout your home with our reliable Wi-Fi technology. For a limited time, get Ignite Internet starting at $59.99 after a credit of $30 per month for a year, subject to change. Only with Rogers. Visit Rogers.com or your local Rogers store for details.